entire landscape has changed as a result of the pandemic. And I would say, you know, when we're looking towards the future, it's unknown. And that's one of the things that is so exciting, but also troubling at the same time. You couple that with the degree change and all of the educational changes that we have.
Welcome to the NATA Cast, the official podcast of the National Athletic Trainers Association. The NATA Cast is your audio source for exclusive insight from NATA, our leadership, and athletic training thought leaders. This show will feature in-depth conversations about healthcare topics that interest you, the athletic trainer. Today's discussion is part of a special series titled Dedicated, in which we visit with ATs who have a passion for the profession. Whether it's in a leadership role, an AT who is making strides in research, or a member who is bringing increased awareness to the profession by working in an emerged setting. Dedicated highlights their stories and path as they advance athletic training.
Hello, and welcome to the Dedicated podcast series. I'm your host, Katie Scott, certified athletic trainer and association project manager at NATA. Today's guest is incoming board of director, District 4 director, Scott Lawrence. Hi, Scott. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Katie. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Scott, you've got potentially 5 years ahead of you as a board member for District 4. Looking a little bit to the future, when you and I revisit this conversation 5 years from now, what do you hope to accomplish as a board member?
Well, I don't know that I come into this role with any kind of preconceived notions of what I hope to accomplish. I think for me, success 5 years from now looks a lot like being able to contribute and being able to have those conversations and ask the questions that need to be asked. One of the things I've always kind of prided myself on and really tried to do throughout my different service roles is be the voice that asks questions that maybe aren't popular questions, but need to be asked. And sometimes those confirm the plan of action that we're about to undertake. Sometimes they change it. But I think to me, that's what I'm looking forward to is just being able to be there, be able to help guide and direct the association and be that person that doesn't necessarily settle for status quo, that looks to the future, that says, here's what athletic training can be and where it could go and what are the perils that could disrail that or what are the opportunities that could benefit from that. And if we can answer those questions and work together, I'm positive that we'll be successful.
Share with me a little bit more about your pathway to leadership prior to the board. A lot of your board colleagues on previous podcasts kind of talked about their involvement on the DSTs and on the district executive. You have a little bit of a unique pathway in that you were very highly involved with our state association councils. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. So my pathway is different than I think what you might call typical, although I would say it's becoming a little bit more common. We have a couple of the other incoming members that have a maybe a little bit similar pathway to mine. My pathway started with the State Association here in Indiana, and I got started with probably the job that nobody wanted, and that was corporate sponsor coordinator. And I was the guy who went door to door knocking on each corporation's email, so to speak, and asking for money. And I had no experience and no skill set to do that, but I learned and adapted and did a fair enough job that eventually I became the finance committee chair. And after a couple years, they asked me to run for president and was not successful. How about that? I actually got crushed in my very first election and almost walked away from the entire thing. Was really hard. And I think a lot of people probably do experience something like that and walk away from service opportunities. Fortunately, my wife talked me out of that. And a couple years later, I ran for president again and was elected and served for a couple years as president. In Indiana, we have a six-year progression, 2 years as president-elect, 2 years as president, and then 2 years as past president. I know many other states do something similar. In that time, I had a seat on the GLADA District 4 board as our state representative. And so started experiencing what service at the district level was like. And after 2 years, was asked to run for president there and was the GLADA president for 2 years. And that's really a four-year progression, 2 years as president-elect and 2 years as president. And I had always been this advocate for states and state associations, and so was serving as a member of the state association group, which is an old remnant of what is the SAC now, the State Association Advisory Committee. So I knew what the national coordination effort was and what it was like and what was going on, and had the opportunity then to be involved with that group. And so served on that committee as a member for 2 terms. And at the end of those 2 terms, was asked and really honored to be able to chair that group, and served for 4 years as the chair of the State Association Advisory Committee. And then here I am. So I come off of that role as committee chair and was elected by the membership in District 4 to be their next director.
Talk a little bit more about your experience being the chair of the advisory council. What was that like? What kind of things did you guys accomplish during your time there? Talk to me a little bit more about your experience on the SAC.
Yeah, the SAC was one of the, if not the single greatest service experience that I've had to date. I think this was an opportunity for me to have a significant impact across multiple entities. And when we look at our constituents in that committee, it's a bit unique. Our constituents are the state associations, and it's different than maybe the ICSM, where you're servicing the college athletic trainer, or the secondary school committee, where you're serving the secondary school athletic trainer. We're looking at state associations, and the state association itself has the ability to influence all settings and all athletic trainers. So I really saw this as a really great opportunity. And, you know, state associations vary so much in what they're able to do. Some of that is a function of size, and some of it's a function of resource. For example, in my state, we're considered a large state. We have around 1,400 members versus a state like Wyoming, and I'm just choosing that one because I know that's in our smallest member caucus or division. And you know, it's two different types of states. Even though Wyoming dwarfs Indiana, our membership is significantly larger than theirs. I want to believe their membership is in the neighborhood of 50 athletic trainers, and I'm probably misquoting. Apologies to the Wyoming Association for probably misquoting that. But what we were able to do with SAC is try to give states resources. That was our mission, to provide education, to give resources, both monetary and educationally, to help them achieve their mission. So some of the things that we did include the development of SAC state grants. That's hard to say right there. Yeah. But you know, we developed a program that awarded money to state associations so that they could start to take risks. It's really challenging when you have a limited budget and limited resources to try new innovative programs, and you do so at your own peril, because if they don't work financially, you could take the association in a negative direction. So this really helped to free associations from that and allowed them to do some really cool things. And we saw in the pre-pandemic years, a number of states tried some really cool things as a result of that program. We were able to institute other programs such as leadership development programs. We have a program that was developed and approved by the board to have an experiential leader platform. So to take someone who's interested in becoming a leader and give them experience. And, you know, we have so many great programs such as the Leadership Academy and others that really give individuals a lot of knowledge. But we thought we needed it. Programs that give them experience. And that's what that program was about. So think about the young, up-and-coming athletic trainer, maybe is a year or two out of school, has started to develop an interest in service, and their state says, we think you might do well in this. They could sponsor that individual, and they become someone that we would be able to bring into our group, the SAC group, as well as with the state association and help mentor them through a leadership pathway. So those are two of the programs that I'm probably most proud of from my time as the SAC. Of course, we did a lot of other things as well, but I think those two programs really had direct impact on state associations.
For our listeners today who maybe aren't quite involved at the state level yet, but would be interested in getting involved, what advice do you have to them?
Again, just do it. You know, when we look at getting involved, I was under the impression that it took a huge amount of time and that that wasn't for me. That was for the elite athletic trainers. And I quickly learned that that's just really not the case. And I look back on that 25-year-old self and, you know, when I first started into my service, and I just kind of think, gosh, you know, why did I think that? I don't know why that perception's out there, but it certainly is. And I think, you know, when we look at folks who are interested in getting involved, so many times I hear, well, I can't do it because, and you hear things like time. I don't have the time to do that. Or I've got this going on, and once that's done, I'll be able to do it. And I'm reminded of a quote from Sir James Lubbock, I believe, or John Lubbock. And he says, in truth, people can generally make time for what they choose to do. It's not really the time, but the will that is lacking. And that was the case for me. It really was. When I first started, I didn't think that I had the time. In fact, I turned down that corporate sponsor position three times before I accepted. And it was all the typical reasons. Well, I'm busy at work. Just had my firstborn son, and I don't have time to do it. And it came down to, it wasn't my time that was lacking. I just had to decide to do it. And I'm so glad I did. So I hope that individuals listening, I hope you do as well. There's never going to be a better time than the present.
Totally agree. Scott, looking a little more towards your professional career outside of the volunteering that you've done, higher education, mm-hmm. Teaching our future professionals, proud Purdue Boilermaker. How did you end up where you are today in your career?
Yeah, boiler up. Gosh, how did I end up here? It was never where I intended. So when I was coming out of school, I was intent on being the next Kevin Wilk. And if you're not familiar with Kevin, he's a physical therapist, very involved in sports medicine out of Alabama. In fact, he's Dr. James Andrews, primary physical therapist. And so that's who I wanted to be. I wanted to be someone who was working clinically, who was helping people recover from surgeries, and helping athletes get back to what they love to do. And, you know, honestly, I was on my way to doing that. I was working clinically, had been doing that for, I had a clinical career for about 10 or 12 years. And towards the end of that, I found the best part of what I was doing was not my patient interaction. It was the students that I was being a preceptor for. I enjoyed that more than anything. And that in combination with the couple courses that I had started to adjunct teach really led me into this new career. And when people heard that I was making a transition into academia, they said I was crazy. And I said, well, you know, it's still athletic training. And they said, no, it's not. I said, well, yeah, it is. I'm just on a different sideline. Mm-hmm. And people kind of said, okay, I see where you're going with that. And started at the University of Indianapolis and loved every bit of my time there. I'm a two-time graduate of the University of Indianapolis, and the Greyhounds are always near and dear to my heart, and really grew leaps and bounds. They took a chance on me, and I'll forever be indebted to them as someone who had no experience teaching. And they taught me how to be an educator, how to teach. And I fell in love with it. Absolutely. And just kind of grew. And my pathway eventually led to Purdue when the program director here was retiring. I had a conversation with him and asked me to apply. And I did, and was fortunate to be named as program director here at Purdue University. And now in my seventh year, really enjoying it. We're growing as a program. We're thriving. And couldn't be happier here in West Lafayette.
So much has changed in terms of being a teacher, being an educator, a mentor now since 2020. The game has completely changed. What do you think are some of the greatest challenges educators face in today's world?
Boy, is that not the biggest understatement in education right there. You nailed it there, Katie. Everything has changed. The entire landscape has changed as a result of the pandemic. And I would say, you know, when we're looking towards the future, it's unknown. And that's one of the things that is so exciting, but also troubling at the same time. You couple that with the degree change and all of the educational changes that we have in athletic training, and it leads to this big kind of nebulous cloud of unknown. And I think that's one of the things that we're feeling in higher education is we just don't know what's going to happen. With students still are the same as what they've always been. They have some differences in how they want to learn and how they want information given to them. But, you know, that's incumbent on us as educators to be able to meet them where they're at. I've always said that. So I don't think that's changed too much, but it's really the whole landscape of higher education is altered. And that's, we're seeing that in budgeting models, administrative models, teaching models, research models. All of those are adapting in this post-pandemic world, and trying to navigate that can be a challenge. So yeah, I mean, the whole world is changed, even for experienced educators. It's almost like just starting all over again in some ways.
Yeah, you've mentioned that at Purdue, you guys are thriving through all of this, which is incredible to hear. Uh-huh. Have you or your staff found any tips, tricks, resources, things that have helped you guys maintain that thriving environment in a time where there's so much uncertainty?
If I had it to bottle up and give, I certainly would. I think, you know, one of the keys to our success is, you know, even though we're a large institution, Purdue's 50,000 students, we're an R1 classification institution. We are still a small program at heart, and it's that individual attention, and we have just dedicated faculty, very experienced. My colleagues are second to none. I fully believe that. Really proud of the team that we have here. We're all involved. We're all clinicians. We're all researchers. We're all scholars and all teachers. And we do that with the student. It's a one-on-one interaction, and there's no shortcutting that. And I think part of the reason we've seen growth, part of the reason we've seen students come, I mean, our pre-professional program has grown from 45%, I want to say, in the last few years. That's huge amounts of growth in a time where we're seeing a lot of contracture. Part of that is one-on-one attention and students feeling like they have a home. And we certainly believe that here. It's always been the culture, certainly well before I was here, and that dates all the way back to Mr. Newell and was continued by Denny Miller and Dr. Leverenz. So that culture, I think, has allowed us to really blossom during this post-pandemic time.
So, Scott, we do have a couple questions from our membership that they submitted prior to this podcast. One question that a student submitted was, if they came up to you in an elevator and asked you, what do you love about athletic training, what would you say?
I'm pausing because I believe there's so many things that I would say. What do I love about the profession? I think the thing I love the most is the ability to work with someone and help them move from the lowest of their lows to the highest of their highs. And all athletic trainers get to experience this. And it's when you take someone who has been injured, who has had some type of condition, whether it's acute, chronic, emergent, and move them through a process that is strife with, you know, challenges, and it's filled with potholes and different barriers. And now all of a sudden, what you've got is someone who's overcome those, and you see that change in them. You see the progression and the movement towards a full health status. And now they come back and they are either partnering with you to improve themselves. They're partnering with you to ensure that a second injury doesn't happen, whatever the case may be. But that's the piece that I love. And for someone who's either a young professional in the field who's just starting to experience that on a regular basis, or for someone who's considering athletic training as a profession, I think that's the thing that I love the most, is being able to do that. And, you know, in my educational role, I see that every day as well, not from a student athlete standpoint or a patient standpoint. I see it in our students, our athletic training students. It's when they go from that challenging course or topic and they finally start to understand it, the dots are connecting. Now they're being able to use what we've taught in class in their clinical practicums. They're using that to help save individuals from injury. I've had students go out and save lives, and that's just so rewarding for me to have the students come back and you know, either say thanks or come back and talk about that and debrief about it. So I still get that same feeling as I did when I was a clinician. So for the young athletic trainers out there, I think that's the thing I love, and I hope you love it as much.
That's awesome. Another submitted question we have comes from a student who's about to graduate in May. And they asked, what advice do you have for me as I transition into becoming a certified athletic trainer? Do you feel that I am prepared to go right into my first job, or should I look at other avenues as I prepare?
Yeah, for the students who are graduating, I think you are prepared to go into that first job. We wouldn't issue you a national certification if we did not think that you could do the job. And the old history of going into a graduate assistant position is no longer the pathway that it is or should be typical, in my opinion. You are qualified to be an athletic trainer in a multitude of settings, so go out and do that. But my advice would be, take advantage of those opportunities. Opportunities multiply as they're seized, and the more you can take advantage of, the more you're going to learn. And your education never stops. So don't think that it's over just because you graduated and you got your Board of Certification credential. Continue to learn, continue to grow, take advantage of the opportunities, and you'll be able to propel yourself forward. Now, if you choose to become a specialist, then pursuing some type of a residency program or a fellowship program absolutely can help you get there. I was a specialist athletic trainer myself. I did nothing but knees for 5 years. That was my clinical practice. And specialty practice is really, really great if that's what you want to do. I'm a product of that. I wish that there had been some of those avenues available when I was going through the process. So I think get out there, experience, work, grow. And, you know, if you choose to do more, there's always avenues to do that.
I love that answer. A third question we had that came in comes to us from a certified athletic trainer in her first certified professional job. And she says, I have less than 5 years of certified experience, and one of my newer responsibilities is being a preceptor for AT students. I don't feel very prepared to be able to successfully lead them as they come into certification. Do you have any advice, tips, or resources for me so that I can be a good preceptor to them?
Yeah, what a great question. And, you know, in some ways, that's a bad position to be in, but in some ways, it's a great position to be in. And, you know, it's hard when you're just inches older than the student you're working with, right? To be a mentor to them, because, you know, a few months ago or a few years ago, you were, you know, maybe side by side with that person in the classroom. I think, you know, the best preceptors are authentic and take interest in the student. And that is irrespective of their knowledge level or their experience level in the profession. When I talk to students, they always say the best preceptors are the ones who value me as a person and take an interest. They never, or they rarely say the best preceptor is the one who has the highest skill level. So I think you can do that even if you're in those first couple years of your practice. So if you are year one or two or three and you have a student, be genuinely interested in who they are and what they are, be honest with them about what you know and what you don't know, and learn together. And that is going to be the makings of a really great preceptorship. Give them the opportunities to practice, be their safety net, but just be interested in them and watch them grow.
I know, too, that the Professional Education Committee with NATA has created a lot of resources and webinars and chat series as well to help arm them. We'll make sure to link all of those resources in the show notes, too. I think one of the things they do is like a monthly Zoom session. I'm not sure if it's currently active, but we will find all those resources and make sure to post them in the show notes.
Yeah.
But I can relate to that question really well. I remember my first certified job came with a preceptor responsibility, and I was terrible at it. I fell on my face. It can be overwhelming. So I love the advice that you had for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would maybe just echo those resources. We use them here in our program. And for our preceptors, we really try to arm them with tools to help them become better preceptors. But you know, nothing replaces just good old fashioned, I want you to succeed. If you can have that attitude and that outward affect with your student, you are going to have a really good relationship there.
Scott, if you could have a conversation with yourself at 25, what advice would you give him?
Well, 25, wow. I got to think back to what I was doing at 25, you know. Let's see, 25 years old, where was I? I was coming out of PT school. I had completed my athletic training program, had gotten a master's in athletic training, and I was in the physical therapy program at the University of Indianapolis, working as a graduate assistant athletic trainer there. And so what advice would I give him? You know, here we are 25 years later almost, and I think I would say two things. Number one, the passion that you have at 25 and the love of what you do at 25, it's still there and it's still burning bright. And, you know, you are making the right choice in the pathway that you're going down. And then the second thing I would say is that athletic training is on the verge of something big. You know, 25 years ago, you gotta go back, or when I was 25, which is almost 25 years ago. You got to think back to that time. And, you know, I wanted to be someone who worked in a clinic. And at that point, athletic trainers really didn't do that. And in Indiana, we certainly didn't. Our Practice Act really allowed for it, but it was not common. Mm-hmm. And so my second piece of advice to myself at 25 was, you know, hey, athletic training is on the verge of something big here. And those emerging settings are about to happen. And you know, really, maybe this PT thing isn't needed. If you stay the course with athletic training, you could really be able to forge a path for athletic trainers in the clinical setting.
As you have gone then from 25 to now, you obviously had to develop a personal leadership strategy and personal leadership values. Do you have those that you want to share with the group today? How did you discover them? How did you develop your leadership style?
Through a lot of trial and error, a lot of mistakes. And I think what I've come to is sort of on my own organic set of leadership values. And none of them are original, but I think how I use them might be certainly original to me and the context. But you know, I think the first thing that I really value is transparency. And I really like to have open, honest conversations. And I think if you close things off, whether that's closed session meetings or not communicating information, either purposefully or unintentionally, I think that really shows that you are trying to hide something. And maybe you're not trying to, but to me, nothing illustrates this whole culture of I don't know what's going on more so than just lack of transparency. And, you know, when you look at my time, and my service roles, where I really learned that the most was when I was GLADA president and we were going through the district split proposal process. So that started under my term as president and of course was continued during the presidency of Ryan Wilkinson out of Illinois. And you know, he and I both pledged at the very start to be very transparent about the process, the data that we were collecting, the outcomes. And you know, when I think about the people that we interacted with and the members that we interacted with, our whole thing was if we treat people like adults and have adult conversations and give adult information, you can make adult decisions. And that's what happened. And I think it was as a result of being transparent with them and not trying to hide things and not trying to take information and allow rumors and speculation to really erode the trust that we were trying to build. Because all that does is diminish what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I don't think many people realize just how significant that split was. You guys did such a phenomenal job making it seem so seamless that I think a lot of our members might find it was easy. It was quick. It happened. You know, it's great. And people don't realize, like, that was bylaw changes. That was huge.
That
so
was,
congratulations
that was huge.
Again
it
to
was,
GLAAD on being able to accomplish that.
Well, it was bylaw changes across states, across districts, and across the National Association. It was, I guess, not at the National Association, that bylaw already existed, but you know, it was something that really required a significant effort, and it was a multi-year effort. At the GLAAD level, it was led by so many individuals, and then you know, the work of Director Vol. Taking that around to each of the districts, again, being transparent, being open and honest about what we were doing, why we were doing this, why we thought it was a good idea. You know, Katie, one of the things you may not know is that this GLAAD split proposal had been brought forth on several different occasions. This was not a new idea and it was not a novel thing. It was something that had been talked about. But I think, you know, one of the things that we did is we said, you know, we want to get all of the information. We're going to see this through. We're going to go into it without any type of preconceived notion or bias. And with that, we're going to let the data go where it goes and we're going to let the members decide. And so that was a really rewarding experience.
Scott, have you ever had a big like learning lesson moment? Or is there anything in your leadership pathway that you look back now and go, I maybe would have done that differently?
Yeah, there's a lot of those. I think probably the moment that sticks out most is my time on the Indiana board. As that came to conclusion, and I moved out of the position of president into the position of past president, that comes with a responsibility of being the senior member of the board. And really, that responsibility is supposed to be someone who's a little bit more hands-off, a little bit less vocal. And I think one of the things that I struggled with is making that transition. After spending 6 years on the board as a voting member on the finance committee chair position, and then 4 years as president-elect and past president, it was really hard to let go of those reins. And I think one of the mistakes that I made was still trying to hold on. And I think that really kind of helped me understand how I needed to compromise and how I needed to allow others to have ideas that can come in and complement and shape and build upon some of the things that we might have done or might be doing in order to move things forward. That's probably the number one thing that I would redo if I had the chance. Lots of other examples that I could probably go into. I've made tons of mistakes. If you talk to some of the other folks around the state here, I'm sure they can give you many examples of things that I've done that that they either disagreed with or would like to have seen me do differently.
I love your explanation, though, because as you were sharing your story, the thought that popped in my head is how many ATs could relate to that, where maybe they've been working with a student athlete or a patient for 6 months, a year on returning to play from a significant injury. And maybe there's a sport assignment change. Maybe there's an ATPT that gets brought onto staff. And now that AT is expected to collaborate and work with another certified athletic trainer on providing care to that athlete. it may be hard to feel like it's time to let go and let someone else come in, especially if you've developed such a trusting relationship with that athlete. Mm-hmm. But think about all the possibilities and the opportunities that come with bringing in another fresh set of eyes, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's kind of where my brain went as you were sharing your experience.
Yeah, that was a painful lesson for me, but it was one that really was important. And I think you're right. It draws parallels to so many different situations. And being able to see another point of view and walk in someone else's shoes and really digest what they're saying, listen to what they're saying, not just hear it, but listen. And that's such an important skill. And I didn't have that at that time. And I really developed it there. And, if I was going to do it over, I'd do that over in a heartbeat. But you're right. There's so many other applications to that that I think run parallel to that story.
So Scott, as we wrap up our interview today, which has been phenomenal, and I really appreciate your time, the word that I've heard you say quite a few times in our chat today has been pivotal. Athletic training is in a pivotal place. We're in a really important place in our profession where it might be unknown, but the opportunities are endless. So my question to you is, what do you hope to see in the profession in the coming years? And what is your ask of our profession as we go through this pivotal time together?
Yeah, I think you said it there. Opportunity is the word that I think most of students would associate with me. That's something I'm always talking about. What's the opportunity ahead of us? And as a profession, we have that. When I look forward, one of the things that I hope that we as a group do is is progressive. I think so many times in our profession, we fall back to how things have been and how things were. And maybe how we did things is okay, but how can we do things is what I'm interested in. Where can we go and what can we do as a profession, in the future? Should we be the preferred healthcare provider for all active individuals? I think the answer to that is absolutely yes, unequivocally. Mm-hmm. Should we only limit ourselves to athletes as we have in the past? I don't think that's the answer. Should we only work in our traditional settings? No. And we've seen that growth occur in the last 20 years and will only continue and accelerate. I think, as I look forward in the profession, I see continued growth. I see continued expansion. And that doesn't dilute or diminish our traditional settings. I think our bread and butter is always going to be our bread and butter. And that's, collegiate athletics, high school athletics, professional sports. Those are always going to be important settings. And we're not diminishing one setting to expand in another. This is a profession that has not hit its ceiling yet. When I meet with students, that's one of the things I tell them is we're still feeling out who and what we are and where we can be. And as we look to the future, that's what I hope we continue. We want to continue to grow and see what we can do. We've done that through educational change, through Practice Act enhancement, and through regulatory and legislative changes. We've seen growth in advocacy efforts. And, people talk all the time about, I see the discussions and hear the discussions about, people need to know what athletic trainers are. They know who we are. I'm going to take a different approach. Our name recognition has never been better. When I talked to students at the beginning of my career and I said, how many of you know what an athletic trainer is? Nobody raised their hand. And now everybody does. Yeah, there's always going to be people out there who don't know what athletic training is. That's going to be a battle for the entirety of our career. But you know what? That's no different than any other profession. I have conversations with my nursing faculty colleagues, and they're frustrated because people don't know who and what nurses are. Mm-hmm. I have conversations with my physical therapy faculty colleagues, and they're frustrated because people mix up physical therapy and personal training. That sounds familiar, right?
Oh, yeah.
Those conversations happen in every profession. We're not unique there. Our name recognition is better than it ever has been. So let's use that. Let's continue to build it. Yes, but let's use that and let's grow that and let's take advantage of the advocacy efforts that are out there to really push into some new territories and take advantage of those opportunities as they come along, seize them and run with them, grow who and what we are.
Love that answer, Scott. Final thoughts for our audience today?
If you are an athletic trainer, you are in one of the best professions out there. I'm sure everyone on these podcasts says the same thing here, or some variation of it, but I truly believe that. I have had a career that is now stretching into its 26th year, and I couldn't be happier. I love what I do. I love the people I work with. It has given me so much. It's given me a family. It's given me a living. It's given me purpose. You know, there are hard times, there are good times, and there are great times. And for me, the great times have far outweighed any of the bad times that I may have experienced. So, what a time to be involved in this profession.
Scott, thank you again for your time today on today's podcast. This has been just an amazing conversation with you. I loved all the topics that we were able to explore today. So I just wanted to thank you again. For those listening, we always welcome and encourage your feedback. You can do that by sending us some comments and feedback on social media using our various handles that'll be linked in the show notes. You can also email me at engage@nata.org. We'd love to hear from you on your thoughts on the show and maybe give suggestions on other people we should bring on and interview and talk to. Until then, please visit the show notes and check out all the resources as well as the other podcasts we have lined up. Until then, have a great rest of your day. Thanks again, Scott.
Thanks, Katie. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in to Dedicated, a special series of the NATA Cast. All resources mentioned during this episode can be found in the show notes or at nata.org/podcast. Listen, we want to hear from you. If you'd like to let us know what you thought or even what you want to hear in future episodes, send an email to the nata.cast@nata.org. And to make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the NATA Cast and rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time.